You're listening to That Life Then. Rat-a-tat-tap. Written and read by Jack Merrill. In terms of the desire to possibly better yourself, my parents regularly floated the notion that any sort of prolonged study was ultimately a futile endeavor. If you weren't good at something, you didn't do that thing. You did something else. Conversely, if you were good at something, that was exactly what you did, and that thing that you were good at would morph into the major part of your identity as it would become what you did. None of this doing required extended study. My father had always been a writer, so he became a journalist. Simple. You became what you were supposed to be by doing what you were good at, and then you got better at it by doing it more. You didn't try to do something you weren't good at. That's just stupid. And you certainly didn't study something you weren't good at. Studying didn't put you any closer to the thing you weren't supposed to be doing in the first place. It just took up time and money, putting off the inevitable day when you'd have to go out there in the real world and get a paying job doing whatever it was you were good at. If you had to study something before you were paid to do it, that meant you weren't really good at it. So why would you want to waste your time studying it? The idea being that studying and doing were two distinctly different things, and studying was a meandering path that did not necessarily lead to the doing. You threw the ball that you were always good at throwing, and then you threw it further. If you didn't throw balls decently from the first toss onward, then sports involving throwing balls were not for you. My father, Jerome Holtzman, was a well-known sports writer who covered baseball and basketball, yet never taught me how to throw a baseball or shoot a hoop. Never. Ever. Believe me, I wish my father had taught me how to throw a ball or shoot a hoop. It was not very attractive to be the son of a man whose name smacked the baseball and basketball and not be one to possess the most basic skills in those sports. It was appalling, actually, and embarrassing. My way out of the situation was not to acknowledge my lack and then better it through attempts of improvement through study. No. As I had learned at home that study was a waste of time for one who was not naturally gifted at throwing balls, I just covered as best I could by ditching gym class and then avoiding all baseball diamonds and basketball courts for the rest of my entire childhood and beyond. When I asked my father why I'd never taken the time to toss or dribble any balls with me, he said, "You were never a very big kid, and you naturally took to water, so I figured you'd make a good swimmer." And so it had been decreed. There'd be no ball throwing and lots of water splashing. I was a decent swimmer, had I wanted to swim, but I never wanted to go near any pool or other body of water in the middle of Chicago's brutally freezing winters, which was exactly when the swim team I was coerced into joining trained. After practice walking outside in single-digit temperatures, any moisture remaining in my curly hair would immediately become hardened icicles. My swim teammates and I used to amuse ourselves as we waited for our rides home by standing around amid all the ice and snow in our down-filled Alaskan parkas, holding open our wet bathing suits in such a way that they'd freeze open, looking like there was an invisible boy inhabiting them. To remain on the swim team in good standing, you had to be wet and in the pool swimming your little heart out 2 out of 3 practices a day. And you had to attend all 3 practices if you wanted to compete in any swim meets. Well, if I was going to spend all this time dunked in the chilly drink, I was determined to compete against all the other wet fools out there. And so I attended a practice every morning at some insane hour before school started, then another one after school, then home for dinner, then back to that fucking pool for an evening splash. I quit the team after freshman year. My father often spouted his belief that ongoing study without an ongoing career was a ruse created by people who didn't have the talent to do, or were putting off the doing by studying how to do it. For example, he found the idea of going to college to study journalism insanely ridiculous. If you wanted to work at a newspaper, you did like he did. You wrote in your high school newspaper, and then presto, you became a journalist. If you couldn't immediately find yourself a job that paid you a decent salary to do whatever it was you were good at, then you weren't any good at the goddamn thing in the first place. My father had a general disdain for higher education, as his education didn't go past high school, and he had a very successful career. And if he could do it, so could you. He'd often rail about men he worked with at the newspaper who possessed, quote, useless degrees, and never once had a conversation with me about the possibility of where and when or whether or not I'd be attending college. School was a place you went when you were an underage child to gain some sort of generalized knowledge. You walked yourself over to school, you learned a couple foundational things like English and math, and then you went out in the world and got a job. Period. Schools also presented a convenient place to stash the kids during the week. Other than that, if you want to learn something, go read a book. My mother was in total agreement. Yeah, I think my mother secretly saw herself as an undisciplined underachiever, and any discussion concerning the attainment of new skills or positive work habits, which could lead to the attainment of new skills, would cast her daily display of a complete lack of discipline in a negative light, and therefore was not to be discussed. She never talked about her own education, other than the fact that she was bad at math, and that the famous director choreographer Bob Fosse was a year or two ahead of her at her public high school on the north side of Chicago. When I started entertaining the idea of becoming an actor and wondered how one went about doing that, she told me that she'd heard Jimmy Cagney on the Johnny Carson show or somewhere like that say that he didn't believe in acting training. Acting was something you just did. And so if I wanted to do it, I should just go do it. Thanks, Mom. I figured there were a couple things I might be good at, but as nobody was throwing any dough in my direction to go do them, I decided to deal with more pressing issues, like getting the fuck away from my negative family. By the time I was 19, I'd already been out and in my own apartment for over a year, and thanks to fake IDs, I'd found employment at a few jazzy restaurants and nightclubs on Chicago's Near North Side, and now found myself working at a private club called Huckleberry's, that was partially owned by the actress Barbara Eden. She was nice enough when she was in town, and one night I asked her how one became an actor. She warmly smiled and said, "Well, find yourself a good class and study hard. Focus, and you too will become an actor. Oh, I also did summer stock. If you can find a theater to work with, that can be very helpful." She was lovely, and I thanked her. You know, that advice was so much better and so much more inspiring than anything I'd heard up until that point. Especially coming from a real actress I'd watched for years on A Dream of Jeannie. Thanks to Barbara Eden, I chose to ignore my father's useless bullshit and that secondhand Jimmy Cagney tale my mother'd been shilling and set myself out to study. Looking around for an acting class or some summer stock, whatever that was, I flipped through the pages of the Chicago Reader, a free newspaper that at that time lay in neat little piles all over Chicago. In the classified section, under notices, I came across something about upcoming auditions for an Arts in the Parks theater production of the Pulitzer Prize-winning George Gershwin musical, Of Thee I Sing. Now, lucky for me, I possessed trace amounts of the natural ability my father found so necessary for involvement in any endeavor, and without ever having had any real part in a play, I got myself cast as a secondary lead in the production. The fact that they were desperate to find a guy my age may have had something to do with it. When rehearsal started, I pretended to understand what was happening all around me, as everyone else seemed to know what was going on. I did a lot of smiling and nodding, wondering if it was going to be possible that in a couple weeks I would be singing and dancing up on a stage in some park somewhere. Apparently the play was a political farce, whatever that meant, and these other thespians, a new word for me, and I were to be in musical numbers concerning a guy named Wintergreen who was running for president. My onstage love interest was a beauty pageant-type pretty girl with big boobs and a big toothy smile who really loved her stage makeup, just caking it on from the first rehearsal onward. We had an actual choreographer to stage the musical numbers, and she arrived wearing that funky layered look Diane Keaton had been sporting on the big screen in Annie Hall. The choreographer was amused at the first warm-up when I told her the reason I couldn't touch my toes was the way I'd been built. "Oh, really? That's why?" she laughed. "Well, you think you'll never be able to reach beyond your knees?" "Well, yeah, I mean, that's as far as I've ever been able to reach," I said. "That's because you're tense. You've never taken class, and you need to work on your extension." "My extension? Wow. I never thought about my extension. In fact, I didn't even know I had extension. This was all very exciting. Of the Icing ran for a week or two, and there's really not much to say, other than not many people came to see it, and my onstage love interest was angry that I wasn't interested in her offstage. Oh, there was a very cute black girl in the chorus who brought me over to her house on the south side of Chicago one sunny afternoon to introduce me to her entire family, and her father took me aside a moment and with a big smile on his face told me never to set foot in his house again. After the show was over, the cool choreographer girl told me I was a good dancer and I should take dance class and she'd go with me. But first, she took me to Capizio's dance store and I bought a pair of white jazz shoes and black stretchy jazz pants and a dance belt. That dance belt was so tight, I only wore it once, and it smashed my junk in such a way I could barely walk, let alone dance. So that part of this whole new dance thing was never going to be happening. She took me to Lou Conti's dance studio, which was in a mostly deserted part of town, not far from where I lived, and a couple blocks up from the biggest gay disco in Chicago called The Bistro, which at that time was Chicago's answer to Studio 54, and where I'd spent many a night dancing high up on a speaker till dawn. Now, I may have known nothing about taking a dance class, but I knew how to get my underage self jobs in nightclubs and pass doormen at discotheques, gay and otherwise. I bought a dance card to put my wallet and get little holes punched in it every time I took class. Then this cool choreographer girl stood next to me at the wooden bar mounted on the wall during my first couple classes, and when the teacher would say some French phrase I'd never heard of, she'd whisper, "Bend your knees," or "Go up on your toes," or "Swing your leg back and forth." The thing that was outstanding about all of this was not my dancing. No, it was that I stuck with it. I actually studied something I'd never done or had any real proof of being good at. Over time, I was able to touch my toes, and I learned all those French phrases. And while I never was really a great dancer, I wasn't so bad either. And I learned that I wanted something I'd never even considered before. Discipline. I showed up on time. I didn't make a joke out of it. I tried the best I could, and I got better. There was a girl around the studio who wore a t-shirt that said, "Dancers are athletes too." That t-shirt made me happy. I was learning something new, and I was an athlete too. Everything about Lou Conti Dance Studio was interesting to me, including Lou Conti. I was nowhere near the level to get into his class, but that didn't stop me from chatting him up whenever I could. He lived right near me, which was convenient as he was much more attentive when I ran into him away from the studio. I thought he was handsome, in a peculiar man-boy way, and although he wasn't overly interested in me, we did go out on a couple dinner dates where he mesmerized me with stories of touring all over the world dancing in this show or that show, and when he kissed me, he'd get lost in our kisses, which I found really sexy. And I did sleep over his school apartment a couple of times, but didn't really go anywhere, and I never let on to anyone at the studio. Although, you know, I think a couple of people there knew. Taking that other part of Barbara Eden's advice, I found a scene study class at an arty type school that also offered a few writing classes and enrolled in one of those as well. My writing was atrocious. Really, it was. I graduated high school without the ability to organize any of my thoughts onto a page. After taking a couple years off after high school, working at nightclubs and dancing till dawn, I was good to go back and repair some of the learning I'd missed the first time around. My family had nothing to do with any of this educational desire. They would have been fine if I'd become a go-go boy. Or not. Or who knows what they thought I was going to do with my life. Yeah, it was weird. But my mind was made up. I was furthering my education, whether they thought it was important or not. I wanted to improve myself, and as far as I could tell, studying was the way to go. For my scene study class, I was assigned a scene from a Tennessee Williams play called This Property is Condemned. I didn't have much to do other than sit around listening to a lost country girl as she balanced herself on a railroad track and talked on and on about her slutty sister, Alva. The girl I was assigned to act with in the scene was helpful until she called me one afternoon and told me she couldn't rehearse anymore because she'd come down with the chicken pox. She asked me if I'd ever had it because we'd had a little makeout session at our last rehearsal in my apartment when she was contagious. She said the incubation period was 14 days. I called home and nobody could recall me ever having chickenpox, so chances were I could be coming down with a case of my own. Meanwhile, the writing workshop I enrolled in was capturing my imagination. It was new for me to be engaged as I listened to my fellow classmates read what they had written out loud. I'll never forget a girl who wrote in great detail about the process she went through when she cleaned her kitchen floor, from the placement of her supplies to the smell of the pine sol. Her clean, simple, straightforward storytelling taught me a great deal. The teacher was really stern and a stickler about attendance and tardiness. If you were late or missed any class for any reason, it would affect your grade. I wanted to get a good grade to prove to myself I could do better than the C's and D's I'd always earned. The 14-day mark of my possible pox exposure arrived, and there I was, sitting in this writing workshop, when I felt something itchy on the bottom of my foot. Then I could feel something itching on my arm, and sure enough, I was beginning to break out in repulsive red pustules. Now, if this was high school, I would have been throwing spitballs from the back row. But I'd undergone some changes in my life, and now could be found right up front like the good little student I always wanted to be. After the first half of class, I went to the bathroom, and looking in the mirror, saw more red, pimply things beginning to bulge beneath my face. I went back and told the teacher I was going to have to leave class early as I was not feeling well, and I might be coming down with the chicken pox. Maybe he thought I was kidding, or trying to pull a fast one. I don't know, but he was a real dick about it, and told me that if I left class early, I'd have an unexcused absence for half a class and it would affect my grade. Hey, I'd been working hard. I didn't want my grade going down. So I told him, fine, no problem. I'll stay and infect the entire class. I returned to my seat in the front row and sat down right in front of him. Not 3 minutes into his lecture, he stopped, looked down at me and said, "You're excused." The girl who'd poxed me was now on the road to recovery and told me to be careful as unfortunately the scabby pustules that had popped out all over her face had sloughed off early, leaving deep craters. This really pissed me off, as everyone was always telling me what great skin I had. And now this chickenpox girly from that stupid-ass Tennessee Williams play about that slutty Alva chick was going to ruin my face forever. I took Band-Aids and crisscrossed them over the 7 or so gumball-sized protruding pustules that had now taken residence all over my face. And for the next couple days, I lay in my bed staring up at the ceiling trying to levitate out of my body. It felt like my skin was on fire. It itched so bad. If any of those gross round scabs started to pull off, I'd press them back on, pasting them back down with new bandages. I even sat up on my roof in sunless Chicago attempting to dry them out. Finally, after a couple days, I felt well enough to sneak out to the store to get some much-needed supplies. Hiding under a baseball cap and sunglasses, I turned my Band-Aid-cross scabby-ass face out the front door of my building and ran smack into the one girl in all of Chicago I'd been attempting to impress. She was a beautiful, sophisticated North Shore girl who'd moved downtown like me. And here she was, looking perfect, as usual, in her bright red and yellow sundress. We'd met a couple of times, and I was taken by her and not a little intimidated by her wit, as well as her chic urban beauty. Turning redder than my now brownish postules pustules, I began stammering as she valiantly attempted to hide the repulsed look of curiosity on her face. I blathered on and on, something about being fine, you know, just please ignore the gross scabs all over my face and arms. See, I'm recovering from the chicken pox, and I'm not contagious anymore, and blah, 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 how sorry I was for her to have to see me like this, and I just kept talking on and on and grinning like an idiot. She hesitantly smiled as best she could, expertly excusing herself from my sour display, wishing me all the best on my recovery. Well, now that was never going to be happening. From that moment on, I ducked whenever I saw her, and we never spoke again. The good news was, my paste the scabs back on inspiration worked, and I only have one little scar. But the whole episode was mortifying, all of it, and I never even got to perform that fucking scene. Not long after that, I sat in the Esquire Theater on Oak Street and saw the movie Fame. All my influences up to that moment, my parents, Jimmy Cagney, Barbara Eden, choreographer girl, pine sol loving writer, chickenpox girly, and her slutty sister Alva, all of them meant nothing when compared to the explosive impact of watching actors my age jump around on the big screen in that movie. Now I knew. Finally, it was clear. the only way I could possibly exist from this moment forward was to move to New York City, live in an empty loft overlooking Times Square, wear baggy thrift shop clothes, and cry about my lousy childhood in acting class. And that's exactly what I did. Well, I never did get a lease on that loft overlooking the Panasonic sign in Times Square, but believe me, I knew exactly which window they'd use for the location. Nobody actually lived up behind that window. It looked like a storage space or something, but I'd reassuringly look up at that dark little square for years until they tore the building down. By this time, all those dance classes had morphed me into a fairly proficient little tapper, and now in New York City, I stood standing room at the back of the Winter Garden Theater watching the new Broadway sensation, 42nd Street. The entire proscenium was barely able to contain one spectacular number after another, as an enormous chorus of smiling, sequined rat-a-tat-tappers filled my Midwestern mind with hope. New York City held opportunity for up-and-coming little tappers like me, and I figured I'd better get into a tap class to brush up my Shakespeare. I asked around, and somebody told me the best teacher in town was some guy on Broadway on the Upper West Side. His studio was right on the third floor corner, his name plastered in big letters all over the windows. After climbing the steep staircase, I was told I'd have to show my skills if I wanted to be admitted to his class, and the execution of my triple-double cramp rolls secured me a spot. I started in his afternoon class, which was a couple hours long and not easy. The class was filled with hard-boiled, no-nonsense tappers, and I was thrilled to be included. This best teacher in New York City, or so somebody said, took a shine to me right away, and I knew, in my heart of hearts, that this was a man who knew real talent when he saw it. And with some solid application on my part, in no time at all, I'd be up there on stage at the Winter Garden Theater with the rest of the smiling sequin chorus of 42nd Street, rat-a-tat tapping on top of giant shining coins singing, "We're in the money," literally and figuratively. I worked hard, and my new mentor took extra time showing me nuanced moves and complimenting my style to the entire class. When he'd come over to correct my steps, he'd smile at me and call me beautiful brown eyes. And I knew everyone else in class wanted to puke, but I didn't care, because someone had said he was the best tap teacher in New York City, and now he was singling me out because I was a talented tapper who happened to have nice eyes. There's nothing wrong with that. By the end of class, I'd be soaked through and through, and as I was working as a waiter at night, I had to change straight into my work clothes. There were a couple little shower stalls in the locker room at the studio, the standalone kind that you buy at Sears with thin metal walls and a little curtain across the front. And I was a month or two into taking class when I was in one of those little shower stalls, soaping away, getting ready for work, when I felt something jam against my back, right around the top of my butt. I turned around, and there was my new tap mentor, totally hairy and totally naked, pushing into the stalls, sporting an angry-looking red hard-on. Oh, I'm sorry, I said. I have a boyfriend. I mean, I didn't, but what else could I say? I mean, I'm no prude. It wasn't like I had anything against dating a dance teacher, but I wasn't attracted to him. And I hadn't a clue how we were anywhere near this point in our very limited acquaintance anyway. He said, "Well, he's not here now," or something awful, and started putting his hands all over me. I said, whoa, wait a second. This is all a mistake. Yeah, I understood this was tricky. I'd loved his attention, and now he was looking at me in a way that made me feel I'd let him on. "I'm really sorry," I said. He ignored what I was telling him and kept grabbing at me. I pushed past him out of the stall, leaving his hairy self under the running shower. I dried off in a corner and ran down the stairs towards work. It was raining when I ducked out into the human tide that's late afternoon on Upper Broadway, and I kept thinking about his ugly red dick and that thick hair covering his repulsive body. In my mind, I tried not to make a big thing of it. But what I kept going back to was I hadn't seen it coming. I really thought he was interested in me because I had talent as a dancer, and actors are supposed to have nice eyes, right? I barely said two words to him. We'd never even spoken outside of class. The whole thing was so out of left field. I was angry at him, and I was angry at myself. I didn't know if I should go back to class. But I did. He didn't even look at me. Suddenly, I was no more. This guy, who someone had told me was the best tap teacher in New York City, cut me so cold, everyone in class knew something was up. The chill was palpable. I drilled my double time steps and my wings, or whatever it was we were drilling, fumbling through the combination without focus, but now it didn't matter what I did because I no longer existed. A couple of the girls gave me some side-eyed smirking looks like, wonder what happened to the golden boy. I wanted to punch something and I wanted to cry. I did neither. What I did do was never go back to that class on the third floor studio that bore his name on Upper Broadway. In fact, I never took another tap class. Period. My shoes sat at the bottom of my closet underneath other shoes until they kind of folded over onto themselves under a layer of gray dust. Finally, I tossed him in a bag and dropped him off at the Salvation Army. I don't blame him for ending my rat-a-tat-tapping. I mean, the whole thing definitely stopped me for a while. But if I really wanted to keep going, I would have found another class. But the pause shifted my focus to other pursuits, and it never shifted back. He had taught me a couple new steps, however. The dance of distrust. The pernicious little jig, where I now questioned people's motives in a way I never had before, putting a distance between myself and any gay man I wasn't directly attracted to. I never wanted to be put in that position again. There was a guy I'd known back in high school who had heard about me taking tap class, and sometime later when I was back in Chicago, we went out for a drink, and he started laughing, telling me he thought it was a joke when someone told him I was taking tap dancing lessons, like me taking some dance class would ever lead to anything. I drank my beer, smiling as he went on and on about the mediocre school he was attending somewhere downstate Illinois in the middle of some cornfields. I decided not to tell him that recently I'd been accepted to New York University.